Hello and welcome to the Multiplanetary Society podcast, where we explore topics related to the space economy and the why and how of potentially becoming a multiplanetary species. I'm your host, Timothy Reuter. Today, we are pleased to have with us Dr. Pete Warden, Executive Director of the Breakthrough Institute and former Director of NASA Ames Research Center. Dr. Warden, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Timothy. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. And I'd like to ask to start off with a brief overview of the Breakthrough Initiative for our listeners. I know there's sort of a lot of moving parts there between Listen, Watch, and Starshot. And if you could paint the picture for us, that would be great.
Certainly. The Breakthrough Initiatives started in 2015. Our sponsor for the initiatives was Yuri Milner, is a physicist, an Israeli citizen, but also spends a lot of time in the U.S. and in Europe. But he's been really interested in the big questions. Mm-hmm. The big questions, are things like, how does the brain work? What's the origin and structure of the universe? But probably the one that's of highest interest to him and also to me is about life in the universe. And there were three fundamental questions. Is the first one, is there any life elsewhere? And as the listeners know, we haven't discovered any yet, although we're hopeful in places in our solar system. The second question is, if there is life, is there intelligent life elsewhere? And of course, that begs the question of what you mean by intelligence, I think probably more correctly to say, is there evidence of a technological civilization? The third one is the one that probably excites me the most, is can we send probes interstellar distances in the sort of the lifetime of people alive today, namely later this century? So the first one was announced in as a formal effort with a $100 million commitment in on July 20th, 2015, which was Breakthrough Listen. And it's a major techno-signature effort. We've enlisted the support of most of the large radio telescopes in the world and a number of large optical telescopes, including some spacecraft. That effort is currently managed out of the University of California at Berkeley. And it's in the process of having its main focus shifted to the University of Oxford in the UK. The second effort is probably one of my own scientific enthusiasms, is can we find life anywhere else? And we're considering both places in our own solar system, and probably more to my background and interest is on planets orbiting nearby stars. The final one, of course, is can we go to those stars, particularly the Alpha Centauri system, which is about 300,000 times further away than the planets in our solar system. So they're right next door. all three of them are significant efforts, and I think we've made significant progress in all three of them. We haven't answered any of them yet. We don't have any aliens. We haven't found any place else there's life, and we're working on how to get to the stars.
These are definitely long-term efforts, but one has to start somewhere. And perhaps we can talk now a little bit about what progress has been made since the initiative was announced. I know actually there's been some news in the past few weeks that was pretty exciting. And if you can talk about that, but also just sort of,
What is the news in particular, so I can address it?
I think Breakthrough Listen came up with a new method of identifying techno signatures.
Yep.
And so you talked about all the fancy
I guess I should remember that because I'm a co-author on that too.
Along with somebody who started off when they were a high schooler, which I loved. But anyway, I'm sort of getting ahead of the narrative. I'd love to hear you tell the tale.
Well, I think the Breakthrough Listen, of course, is the longest running program. That's going extremely well. Our primary objective is to at least survey the nearest million stars. Mm-hmm. You're starting to get enough of a statistical sample of the galaxy that might tell us how common or maybe uncommon a technical civilization is. To do that, it's almost impossible with a single dish radio telescope or mm-hmm. even optical telescope. So you need something that looks at the whole sky. We've spent now about 60 million on the 100 million commitment that Mr. Milner made. We've done a lot of work on with single dish telescopes, but we're moving now to array telescopes. And an array telescope is one that you can form a single beam by combining all of the beams, or you can actually electronically pick out individual beams. And probably the most significant radio telescope of that type is the new Meerkat in South Africa. Mm-hmm. It's got 64 radio telescopes. I think they're each about 18 meters in diameter. But it's going to be used to look at a lot of astrophysical phenomenon. But we've built some software and some hardware that, as it looks at any given part of the sky, we can form synthetic beams within the sort of a degree or two of the field of view. So that enables us to, at any given time, have 64 additional observations. So as it moves around the sky over the next 5 or 10 years, we'll be able to look at most of the stars within about 1,000 light years in the southern sky. It also is the first part of what eventually be the world's most impressive and largest radio telescope, called the Square Kilometer Array. Mm-hmm. And it'll eventually have several thousand antennas all over southern Africa. There is an array in the northern hemisphere, the Very Large Array, and we've been working with it as well. So we think we can get the million nearest stars. The next thing, of course, is look for optical signals. I mean, as we realize from our own civilization, we're increasingly using light, laser signals. Mm-hmm. So we have a couple programs. One is we have what's called it's an older telescope, the automated planet finder at Lick Observatory. But it's looking for planets around some of the nearby stars by observing the radial velocity, which is the motion in our line of sight. And a planet would cause the star to wobble in radial velocity. But we put an instrument on that. We can actually look for laser signals. Either close to the star or in the region of it. The other program is probably for optical is even more exciting and much sort of all sky. There's what's called a Cherenkov telescope, which is basically designed, it's kind of a light bucket that looks at flashes when cosmic rays hit the upper atmosphere. But also collects a lot of other stuff, and this one is run by Harvard, called the Veritas Array. We've in agreement with them to look through decades of data to see if we see laser flashes. We've got a lot of other programs as well, but they're all quite exciting. But probably the most interesting, at least the last few years to me, was a little over 2 years ago. The principal investigator, Dr. Andrew Simeon, called me up, and as it turned out, it was on Halloween, and I was here in Europe. And he said, "I think we might have a signal." And so I was jumping up and down. I got a bottle of champagne, and finished it. And I was about to open the second one when he called me back, and he said, "Well, I just want to make sure you understand that these things are most likely interference." Well, all right, we'll look at it. And I said, "Now look, everybody should be really quiet on the team." There was about 15 people on the team. And I said, because we'd like to, before we say anything, we want to know what we think. Right. It didn't take long. About 3 days later, there was a report in the Guardian newspaper that we'd found aliens. But it was the reason it made it particularly interesting, it was the very nearest star, Proxima Centauri, the mm-hmm. small star in the Alpha Centauri system. It's a red dwarf star. And it just a few years before, people had detected from the European Southern Observatory had detected using the radio velocity method, a planet orbiting Proxima Centauri, an Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone. It's now called Proxima B. More recently, there's been a second planet found in that system, and a third one that's the second one is sort of in the habitable zone and sort of Earth-sized. The third one is pretty far out. So that was kind of exciting. We said, oh my goodness, there might be something, you know, there. But after a couple of months, we convinced ourselves that based on some, you know, very detailed tests, that it was almost assuredly interference. I mean, we can't 100% rule it out. But one of the other programs that we've been working with has been working with the Chinese on the 500 meter radio telescope, which is currently the world's largest. And they found, not from Proxima Centauri, but some other stars about 30 light years away, signals that could be similarly evidence of technosignatures. But as with our signal, which we found on the Parkes radio telescope in Australia, by the way, we're now convinced it's interference. But I might add that, you know, you mentioned young people. It was one of our summer students, an undergraduate at Hillsdale College in Michigan, that located it in the data, and it was data that was a year and a half old for the Proxima Centauri data. So there's a lot of opportunities, I think, for younger people to work on this. But this is a very exciting set of programs. And we do hope to do the million nearest stars. We're also have surveyed the plane of the galaxy, you know, where most of the stars are in the galaxy. Now those would be mostly much more distant. And we've looked at 100 of the nearest galaxies if there was extremely bright signal. So none of those are, you know, we haven't found anything yet, but I think the next few years are going to be the most exciting in that area, because I think we'll start to get a complete survey of what might be out there. Now, the paper you alluded to was, could we apply some sort of artificial intelligence to this data? Because in the past, somebody actually had to sit there and look through the data. And so we use the data from the I think it was the Green Bank radio telescope. And we looked at a number of stars that we knew had planets that transited. These are from the Kepler survey. Looked through the data in an AI manner and said, can you find anything? And it came up with a handful that had some signals. Now, we've looked back at those stars and haven't seen anything more. I think it's probably the future is as we get more and more data that we have an artificial intelligence system that will be able to quickly filter through this data and at least give us tentative signals. And then we can follow up with other radio telescopes, other optical telescopes.
Right.
So I'm quite excited about the program. And as I mentioned, it's really a global effort, and we're moving the sort of lead center from Berkeley to Oxford. One of the main reasons to be in the UK is that's where the headquarters of the Square Kilometer Array is located. So it's a very exciting area, and I'm kind of looking forward to what we can get now. And I have to tell a kind of a story about how the thing started. We announced it at the Royal Society on July 20th, 2015, and we had a number of very distinguished people there. It was Professor Stephen Hawking was there, and Frank Drake, the sort of father of SETI.
The Drake equation.
Yeah, Lord Martin Rees, who's the Astronomer Royal and the former head of the Royal Society, and about 8 or 10 other senior scientists, Andrew Ian, you know, the creator of Cosmos and Carl Sagan's widow. And Mr. Milner asked the group, said, what do you think the likelihood in the next decade that we'll find an intelligent signal? And there were sort of numbers bounced around. They went from maybe 0.5% to a few percent. And which was interesting. I mean, that's a low percentage. But then I asked Mr. Milner, I said, what do you think the number is? And he said, 10 to the minus fifth. And to me, that was quite impressive because I said, here's a visionary willing to spend $100 million on something that the experts, you know, the most optimistic experts said was maybe a percent or two of possibility. And he himself believed it was very low probability. And having I'd worked for the government for a long time, you know, the last 10 years of my career as the director of NASA Ames before I'd started this. And I can't imagine going to the government and saying, I want you to spend $100 million for something that the experts think has got a 1% chance of success. Right. And so I think that one of the big messages is the possibility and enthusiasm of getting, you know, visionary philanthropists to fund a lot of these things that are low probability, but the consequence of success is very, very high.
There's a whole bunch of things I want to unpack here because you just said a lot. So let me, before we move on to the next thing, interrupt you with a few questions. First off, I just want to make sure I run to ground the importance of the paper that you mentioned with somebody who is the student intern. So it sounds like, you know, something that was reported in the press at one point, there was an interpretation that there may have been something like 8 potential techno signatures. Now, it sounds to me like you now think that's not the case, but this is still important work because you have a new way to apply AI ML techniques to sifting through large amounts of data. So the technique is still important, but there's not any techno signatures that you think have a higher probability of being, you know, what we're looking for. Is that correct or am I misunderstanding?
No, that's exactly correct. I think the key thing for the listeners to understand is that if we had a validated techno signature, there's a couple of things. One is we'd like to see it a few times. The one we saw a few years ago on Proxima Centauri, we did see a few days in a row. The one the Chinese had detected, it was only seen once. So the first thing is that, okay, you go back to this target later, and as a signal still there, none of these 8 potential signals that we recently pulled out of the data repeated. Now that doesn't mean that it wasn't something there. The second key thing is if you think there's something real there, if it's a single radio telescope or optical telescope that sees it, that it's always potentially an instrumental effect. In fact, in the one with Proxima Centauri, we're now pretty convinced that's the most likely problem, was an electronic problem in the in the system. So if somebody else saw it, if we said that, hey, we saw it at the Parkes radio telescope, let's use the square kilometer or the Meerkat array, and we could do that right away, and we've got ways to do that. So in this case, that we didn't get on it right away, but we went back and looked at it with a couple instruments, and so there wasn't any more signals there, and nobody else saw it. But I guess the importance of the automated process is that it can pull signals out very quickly enough so that we can send an announcement out and says to the rest of the communities that, you know, yesterday we thought we saw something from these objects. Mm-hmm. Go look at them. And that's the way you would validate. If we saw a signal repeatedly, a number of different instruments saw it, we'd say, okay, that's a high probability there is something there. Of course, then the next question is, what is the something? You know, what constitutes a techno signature? And our assumption in the radio, at least, is that nature doesn't produce very narrow band radio signals, that they're artificial. Now, there's always somebody would argue, well, there's some special, you know, physics or something goes on and some strange object, you know, in another star system that could produce that wasn't evidence of the human or intelligent civilization. So those are, you know, that's the the first thing. The second thing is we look for is that the frequency of this signal varies with time. And what that indicates is that it's off the Earth. It's outside the Earth. It could orbit around the Earth. It could be in the solar system. It could be in interstellar space, or it could be in the star system. Now, one of the interesting things about the signal in the Proxima Centauri system is that it did drift in frequency, but the velocity didn't seem to be consistent with a planet orbiting that star. So that was another indication that it's probably not in that system. Because if it was in that system, it might be in a rotating planet or be orbiting around the star. So there's a set of velocities that you would see. These other eight signals, again, since we only saw them once, you know, it was mostly that they were narrow band. In a couple of cases, they were drifting. But there's a lot of things that could cause drift. It could be reflected signal off a satellite. It could be, you know, radio interference in some manner. But what we're convinced now is that if there are signals, especially when we start looking at a million stars, that we'll find them. And so that was the significance of this particular development, that the algorithms we have, the software, the system is fully set up now. If there's a signal there, we're pretty confident we'll see it. Now, what it is, that's obviously, that just starts the excitement. And to validate it, there's obviously, we go back and look at the object again, and we have other people look at it. But this is how science is done. It's quite exciting.
And I want to go a little bit down a rabbit hole, but not too far down it, because it'd take up the rest of our time. You know, what do you think the societal reaction will be if we find something that is convincingly a techno signature? You know, we don't really know what it means, but we sort of think, gosh, there really, you know, most likely is another technologically advanced civilization, you know, say, oh, I mean, you know, let's say around Alpha Centauri, our, you know, nearest net. What do you think the sort of reaction will be to that?
Boy, that's an interesting question. And we've had many drinks with our team in trying to consider that. I guess there would be a multiplicity of reactions. Mm-hmm. There would be some percentage of the public says, you know, so what? We, you know, aliens are visiting us all the time. And you know, we see UAPs and other people believe that we're in contact with aliens through, you know, their, you know, sort of other means, through psychic means and so on. So there's a certain percentage of people that would just yawn and say, well, so what? You found them. There would be another segment of the public that, especially if it was on a star that was close, that might be kind of worried about it. Mm-hmm. Said, okay, if there's an alien civilization in the Alpha Centauri system, you know, maybe we should keep quiet. And
those who have read The Three Body Problem will likely say that.
Which was the Alpha Centauri system, where that problem was. But there'd be a third segment that would say, wow, you know, this is the coolest discovery of all time. And I think I count myself and probably most of the scientific community in that. In some sense, there would be a huge set of optimism. Yeah. I mean, first of all, you're not alone. Second, that, you know, we worry daily about, you know, our civilization ending, or even our life on our planet ending, through, you know, things that we as humans might do, or things that nature does to us, but mostly things that humans might do, you know, all out war, biological catastrophes, ecological catastrophes. And it would tell us that, okay, somebody else is out there, and somebody else might have made it through this. And at least from my perspective, that makes it potentially interesting to communicate with them. But I think that, and of course, that's a different question of, you know, right. If you found something, could you communicate is one thing, and should you is a second. I'm sort of reminded of what my father used to tell me, and I think it was Abraham Lincoln that got credit for this, that said, Better to be thought a fool than to open one's mouth and remove all doubt.
I mean, as a podcaster, I'm clearly not taking that advice, but it's a great quote.
But I think that it would probably be evenly divided. You know, one of the interesting things that we discuss a lot is, would that upset the religious community or spiritualist community? And I don't think so. In fact, one of my dissertation advisors was George Coyne, who was, he was the later became the director of the Vatican Observatory. He's written extensively, and he was quite excited when I talked to him about it. He just passed away a few years ago. I have to tell you, as a graduate student, we used to call him Father Photon. I've talked to a number of people that are into that are, you know, philosophers of religion or religious leaders or spiritual leaders. We're intending sometime in the next year or two to have a conference on the ethics questions of these, and we want to invite a number of people I think that a religious leader has thought about, you know, what's our role in the universe, and using different approaches to try to yeah. understand that. And I am, you know, I am interested in some of the opinions of sort of traditional, religion and spiritualist and so forth. I was just in, as you noted at the beginning, I was in Kenya for a conference that our sister foundation, the 100-Year Starship, held, and they had a number of indigenous African thinkers on this, and it was quite exciting. I mean, sometimes it's difficult, one of the things, as I mentioned about that, it's hard to duplicate, you know, those experiences, but, sometimes one can. So I think there would be a lot of very interesting discussions, but I hope that would inspire our species to do a couple of things. One is maybe figure out what we can learn from them and eventually go there if it's not that far away. But also provide a sense of optimism about our future.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And you sort of now alluded to, this is a multicultural effort working across many different countries. Something that I think is a little unfortunate, I'd like to get your perspective on, is there's something of a Cold War around, at the very least, space technology. You mentioned collaborating with folks in China. And I guess, how do you think about the opportunity, versus the challenges of collaborating with folks who are geopolitical rivals? Obviously, you're in a very different role now. You no longer are subject to the Wolf Amendment. We've seen different things happening with Russia. In some ways, there's more exchange than ever, with a potential agreement for them to go on a U.S. aircraft. In some ways, it seems to be breaking down this, collaboration we've had. How do you think about sort of the opportunity and the challenge of working with rivals in the space sector?
That's another very interesting question. Of course, I obviously have a bit of a schizophrenic background. I mean, one of my titles is general, and I spent 29 years of my life in national security areas as a military space. That a rather interesting perspective. In the mid 80s, I was actually spent a year and a half as on an arms control delegation in Geneva, and we were arguing about space. Space military activities, particularly the, among other things, the U.S. missile defense effort that was dubbed Star Wars. On the other hand, I now work for a global foundation, doing work with people around the world. But it's interesting about the techno signature or SETI area. It really got started in the height of the Cold War, and one of the original impetus was Carl Sagan, worked with Slavsky in Russia, in the Soviet Union. And it became an area that enabled, you know, people around the world, despite political challenges and you know, some sense of warfare, to work together. And it's sort of a way that scientists, I think, can work together. Now, that having been said, it's as you noted, it's certainly a fact that much of modern national security is based on our highest tech things, of which space is certainly at the pinnacle of that. So there's a, you know, I think there's a bit of a, one has to be careful. But one always has to be careful. And in fact, it's probably not much different than scientific competition. You know, if in fact, some of the most nasty conflicts are between scientists over some nuance of science. And it that, you know, and I've been involved in some detailed scientific areas that were, there were three or four groups competing. And you know, you might have had the same objective, but the enemy was that other group. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of a meeting I had probably 25, 30 years ago with the chief of staff of the Air Force. And there was another officer giving a talk, and he kept referring to our enemy. And the chief of staff stopped and says, well, who's the enemy? And he said, well, it's the Soviet Union. And the chief of staff says, no, they're our adversary. Our enemy is the Navy. And I think that's, you know, even in scientific things, that, you know, our enemy might be our competing group that's right. Trying to do the same thing, and our adversaries we can work with on occasion. That
right. So we know where they stand, right?
Yeah, we know the adversary. Exactly. So I sort of see science as a way to lower tensions, and mm-hmm. you know, obviously, you know, in the current war in Ukraine, that the sort of even longstanding interactions with the Russians are very much. Sort of put on hold, but I do hope that you know, as any conflict, it'll come to an end, and hopefully quickly and without a lot more bloodshed and damage. But I suspect that the way things will get back to normal is the earliest one is there'll be collaborations on scientific efforts as there was in the Cold War.
Right. So shifting gears a bit, you've talked quite a bit about two of the initiatives, but I'd like to focus a little bit on Breakthrough Starshot.
Sure.
And, you know, that seems actually quite different in that the organization's taking on a lot more technical risk than the others, doing more novel things on your own. And, you know, can you provide us with an update on how that is going and what you've learned so far?
Sure, and that's another commitment that Mr. Milner made of potentially, $100 million to figure out if we can send probes in our lifetime to particularly the Alpha Centauri system to study the systems up close and mm-hmm. and potentially life-bearing planets. To me, it's the most exciting, but it's also mm-hmm. the longest term. It's the answer was we would like to go to these places this century, not this decade. And of course, I'm 73. I hope to live a few more decades, but I'm probably not going to see these probes go by the nearby stars. Although I think many people alive today probably will. Our first challenge was how do we do this? Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, my first idea was that of course I watched Star Trek. And that we should use antimatter. And it is actually there has been small amounts of antimatter manufactured in high energy particle beams. But it's...
Is this called an anticubic drive or what? There's a...
No, this would be just using a rocket. But okay. And let me kind of put it in context if I send a rocket into space, its efficiency as a rocket is measured by a specific impulse, which mm-hmm. is one way to think about it is for each kilogram of fuel, how much kilograms of thrust do you get, you know, in some set time? So if a typical rocket is 300 or 400, so that means that, you know, if I use a kilogram of propellant and I get sort of the oomph of about, you know, 400 kilograms of force. Now that's not, those units don't match, but that's a way to think about it. If I did a calculation and said I'd like to go 20% the speed of light to get to Alpha Centauri, forget about stopping, how big a rocket do I need and how much fuel? Well, at 300 or 400, it's about the mass of the galaxy. So it's that's sort of, I said, okay, we're not going to do that. Can we do more efficient fuels? And the answer is yes. You know, there are people that want to use a fission reactor to get, you know, specific impulses of 900 or 1,000. You know, that doesn't help much, but a little bit. If you...
So you don't think nuclear...
Let me get there. Yes.
Okay. Maybe. I'm sorry. I'll let you finish your thought, but and then we'll start talking.
You know, if we use electric propulsion, you can get a few thousand, maybe 10,000. If you could actually harness directly the fission, nuclear fission, that, in fact, there was the old idea of using a series of bombs called the Orion, where you dropped well, I'll call it a nuclear charge, that makes it less, you know, provocative, out the back, and you dropped a bunch of them, we could get. And so that's maybe 100,000. Now that starts to get you, you know, maybe a few percent of light speed. If you really wanted to do this, you want a specific impulse of 1,000,000. In fact, it's called the magic million by the people who study it. Fusion gets you close. It's about 500,000. In fact, you could imagine constructing a multi-stage rocket that could get you to 10-20% light speed, that is sort of reasonable size, you know, that's, you know, maybe thousands of tons or tens of thousands of tons. So it's something that you might imagine that you could do. But it turns out if you could have antimatter, you could get 8,000,000. So if I could make enough antimatter and store it, which is another challenge, and their idea is how to do that, but probably not this century. So it's, we have to look at something else. Now there's, if you keep the fuel on the planet, that's, there were a bunch of studies. The most important one was by Professor Phil Lubin at UC Santa Barbara, that said that you could push a light sail with a laser. And so it's a different thing. You're not carrying the fuel with you. And that's very efficient, but you need a really big laser, you know, 100 billion watts, so or more. But the sail wouldn't have to be that big. But if you could make the spacecraft really lightweight, like a few grams in the sail, you know, maybe 10 meters, then that looks like it works. So that's, by the way, the approach we've taken. Now there are others that have looked at more exotic things. And in fact, one of our sister foundations is the Limitless Space Institute, which we've been working with. It's trying to look at more exotic stuff. And one of those was that can you maybe even go faster than light speed? And so you do that, you sort of warp space, basically. And that's the, but it is potentially possible to do it. It's called the Alcubierre Drive. And the problem is that you figure out how much energy you need to do that, and you'd have to annihilate the mass of Jupiter into pure energy. Now there are ideas that Dr. Sonny White, who's the chief technologist for the Limitless Space, thinks can make it a lot smaller. A lot of the scientific community is skeptical that this is allowed, but there's a lot we don't know about physics. The other question is, can you sort of pull energy out of the fabric of space-time? In some sense, this is like if you're, you know, in a ship, can you bring in seawater and push it out, so that it might be done as in like a propulsion system. So we don't have to carry all the material with us. We can do something with it. And those, you know, we don't know a lot about space-time, and its structure. But one of the models is that it's called the quantum background fluctuations. That space time is structured with sort of some sort of, you know, particle type structure that flips in and out of reality, and it's there's a quantum background, and it you know, some people claim you can get a lot of energy out of that. There actually is an effect called the Casimir effect, which if you take two plates of big plates of material and bring them close together, there's an attraction which isn't predicted by anything other than somehow you're tapping in the quantum background fluctuation. I think that there's a potential there. Now, can you get enough energy to push a starship that so you don't have to, you know, do fission or fusion? I don't know. But we're not researching that, but it's certainly an exciting area. We're researching something we know works. But our challenge is, you know, there's another thing our sponsor said, this has to be affordable. Now,
that can mean many things.
Yeah, he's a billionaire. So, I mean, his understanding of affordable is different than mine, but he's not a government. Right. And so his view was that look, if you could build an interstellar probe system that cost roughly what the James Webb Space Telescope or the Large Hadron Collider, you know, roughly $10 billion, then that's something that governments might do. Of course, it's right now pretty speculative. So the private sector, us and others, can do some of the basic research. So our question is, can we do it affordably? And we know a big enough laser could be built, and we could we know we can get the energy through the atmosphere and focus on a sail. We now know, based on our research, that sail materials exist that can take that much, you know, power and reflect it. We think we have a way to communicate back from Alpha Centauri, but the big challenge is, can we build this giant laser thing, and it's kilometers in scale, for, you know, $6-8 billion? And I would have said 5 years ago, no. In fact, if you estimated what lasers cost 5-7 years ago, it would have been $1 trillion. And but we're seeing major breakthroughs in laser devices. One of them is so-called photonic laser, which is basically an electronic component that produces laser light. It's sort of a chip. Mm-hmm. And those do exist, and the cost of those is going way down. So what we kind of think you could do is you would have something that looked like solar panels, and you'd pave over a big area of a region with these, and then you electronically steer them and correct for the Earth's atmosphere perturbation. And we think that's feasible. And we're right now have finished our first phase of Starshot, and we're going back to our sponsor sometime soon, and in our reviewers, and say, okay, does this look like it works? And go on to the next step, which is to begin to build devices, small scale devices, and maybe in a decade build an early system that it couldn't go to Alpha Centauri, but it could throw probes into interstellar space. And so that's kind of where we are with this, you know. And I'd say at least the team and I am convinced that this is very plausible, and that we could probably build this early device for a few hundred million, and we could send things, you know, rather than taking decades to get out of the solar system, you could do it in a year or two. That would get hundreds to thousands of astronomical units, so begin to get, you know, a few tenths of a percent to the nearest star system, and that's the step. It's sort of, you know, build a little, test a little.
So if I sort of understand the model here, the idea is that you are going to take on a lot of the initial technological risk to make it credible for the larger entity of a government
or government
to do this, right? Yes. I mean, if you said, you know, we believe with 80% certainty that we have the technology to go to another solar system, if you spend $10 billion on doing it, you could plausibly get that accepted. If you say there's a 2% chance if we spend $10 billion that this will work, then you're unlikely to get a government to do it. And you've made the point that a rich philanthropist can take on much higher levels of risk to prove something out.
Precisely. And we think that if we build an interim system that showed this worked and it was affordable, within a decade or so, that we could convince governments that this is an exciting enough scientific project that they could take on. By the way, there are kilometer scale optical systems. They are these big solar furnaces, and those don't cost, hundreds of billions. They cost maybe a billion. And
what are they used for right now?
Well, they used to reflect sunlight into a focus area, which is used to heat a fluid, which powers a turbine to build power.
Oh, right.
And there's a number of them in Southern California that are quite effective. And it's so we're convinced that the technology is coming along, but it needs a little more work. We're still not ready. The cost of this system we're talking about is hundreds of millions, even an early system. If I went to NASA or the National Science Foundation and said, give me $300 million, they'd say, well, not yet. but we are seeing an increasing number of visionary philanthropists that are very, very interested in these kind of problems. And I think the what I find most exciting is, I'm an astronomer, and, I talk to astronomers, and of course, our other project is Breakthrough Watch, trying to find, is there a place to go? And by the way, there's an interesting thing I'll get to in a minute about the Alpha Centauri system. Mm-hmm. But they told me that even though they're not working on this Starshot, they said, this is a positive inspiration that there's an unlimited future for humanity, that if you can send things to the nearby stars, it's something that inspires everybody.
Yes.
And it's sort of that goal that it's most other science right now is concerned about horrible threats like the environment and biological threats. So this is a positive thing. So I think it's one of the most inspirational things that we've ever done, or I've ever done. And I think it can work. The interesting, I should probably tell your listeners about the Alpha Centauri system. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are three stars there. There's two of them that are kind of like the sun. They're a little bigger. One's a little bigger, one's a little smaller. And they orbit around each other with an 80-year period. If we were orbiting one of them where the Earth is, we would have a sun, but there'd be a second sun that would be about where the planet Uranus is. And it would be pretty bright, but not, it wouldn't get much heat from it. The third star is Proxima Centauri, and it's a long ways away. It's probably 10,000 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun, and you would see it, but it wouldn't be very bright. It would be, maybe as bright as Jupiter, perhaps, or maybe a little less. And they said we now know there are three planets orbiting Proxima, but it's not a very sun-like star. We hope to find is, are there planets orbiting Alpha Centauri A or B, the solar type stars? About 3 years ago, we had a program we funded with the European Southern Observatory to have a special instrument called a coronagraph, where you blocked out the star, and that system's close enough that a planet like the Earth would be one arc second away from the star. So we had about 100 hours, and we found a signal. It's what's called a three sigma signal, so it's just barely believable. We didn't have any more time on the telescope, but the signal suggested that there is a giant planet orbiting in the habitable zone of Alpha Centauri A. Fascinating. By the way, it's a fascinating coincidence because the Avatar movies feature a giant planet orbiting in the habitable zone of Alpha Centauri A, called Polyphemus, which has moons, one of which is not only habitable but inhabited. So this was exciting enough to us. So Mr. Milner got in touch with James Cameron, And on our we did it online, our annual conference, Mr. Cameron spent about an hour. It's online on our Breakthrough Discuss website, talking about Alpha Centauri. And it's interesting to me is, you know, this is, humans would travel there. And his way they would travel is they would be sent with a laser light sail. And then at the other end, they stop with a fusion propulsion system. So this kind of inspired us. So our system engineer, I asked him, I said, well, what would it take to send a big spaceship to the Alpha Centauri system? You know, if you didn't want to stop, you know, figuring that you have it on board. And he did a calculation and said, you know, actually, we could do that. It's a much bigger system. It's probably trillions of dollars, at least with current view. But we could do it in maybe next century.
Yeah.
And so I think to me, it's exciting now, you know, whether you would actually send humans or you would do something else, who knows? That sort of ties all these things together to me, that I find the Alpha Centauri system fascinating. We have a small satellite that we're launching in about a year that's going to study and see if we can confirm that giant planet and maybe find other planets. But, you know, I think we may find that the nearest star system, our neighbor, is much more exciting than our own.
Well, I will take a look at that on your website, and I encourage the listeners to do so as well. You know, in the final minutes that we have remaining, I want to sort of go up another level of abstraction and get your perspective on why hasn't more progress been made on non-chemical propulsion systems, right? Von Braun, you know, in the 1960s was envisioning a nuclear-powered mission to Mars. The U.S. government actually invested in this through the 70s. You know, why did that end, and why has nothing succeeded until recently? Why aren't other sectors picking this up in a more substantial way?
Well, I think some of the problem with these, you know, it's easy to say that I need a better propulsion system, but sometimes it's a lot harder to build one. And there are significant challenges. As you mentioned, one of the very promising ways is nuclear systems. Mm-hmm. During the Cold War, those, you know, building or pushing a nuclear system was fraught with the policy issues. There was a treaty, the Outer Space Treaty, for example. And, you know, I think that there was a lot of, and there still is a lot of concern of building a true fission or fusion system. The other thing is it's technically hard. You know, we haven't been able to build a fusion reactor that works in a consistent manner on the Earth other than a bomb. And and we've been at that for, you know, half a century. I'm sort of a smart aleck friend of mine used to say that, you know, nuclear fusion is the energy of the future, always has been and always will be. And but I think we're beginning to have enough ability to control things as we get more and more capabilities in electronics and photonics that I'm optimistic in the next decade or so we will have fusion propulsion. The U.S. government, for example, is now pushing nuclear electric and nuclear thermal propulsion. Mm-hmm. Nuclear thermal propulsion offers you a rocket engine that's three times more efficient than the best ones we have today. I might add, you know, the old Orion project, which I mentioned, used a nuclear charge. Mm-hmm. When I was at Ames, we worked with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to say, well, what if we used modern technology and, you know, not stuff they had in the 50s? Could you make something a little more feasible? And in the 50s, a nuclear bomb was, you know, tens or hundreds of kilotons. And the material you had to use is what you did is you drop a bomb off the back of the spacecraft. You had a pusher plate. You would detonate the bomb, push this thing, which had a spring on it. And then you dropped, you know, it's kind of a bump, bump, bump. And when I was at Ames, we developed a new thermal protection system based on woven carbon fibers. And so that was much more efficient. And we now can contemplate nuclear charges that are a few tons of yield, not kilotons. Mm-hmm. And so we started to do some analysis. Says, could you build a ship, a small size ship? I mean, these things in the 50s were, you know, the size of a battleship. And the answer was yes. And you could get to Mars in a few weeks, not years. The problem is, of course, that is a 10 ton nuclear charge. Is that a weapon or not? And so there are certainly issues, but, you know, one hopes that, you know, at some point that even some of those ideas might work, but probably not today. But I'm optimistic that we're going to get there. It's breakthroughs sort of go in the sort of the step function. You kind of run along and then there's a huge jump. One of the visions for the future that I think is, well, it's got some good and bad parts, is that series, The Expanse. Mm-hmm. You know, it features humans living throughout the solar system. And basically, they're traveling between the planets on fusion propulsion. I guess it's called the Epstein Drive. And I think that may happen. And now, you know, I don't know if we're going to end up in, you know, multi-planet species that like that is, although that's not an unrealistic effort. Of course, you know, the real catch in it is is alien technology. Who knows whether that exists or not.
But if anybody's going to find out, it will likely be your organization. You know, is there any sort of overarching body, a trade association or anything, or an academic association focused on novel propulsion systems?
There are a number, and I'm trying to remember that. Well, one of them is I forgot their name. It used to be called the Tennessee Valley Interstellar Group. They've changed their name. In fact, they have an annual conference that is trying to look at some of these. Certainly, the organization that's actually funding the sort of wide range of propulsion is the Limitless Space Institute in Houston, Texas. There are beginning to be groups doing this. We, on occasion, and others have sponsored meetings. There are publications like the New Space Journal that occasionally does special issues on advanced propulsion. So it's I think there's not a single organization like the, you know, AIAA, the American Astronomical Society that is focused on this, but hopefully there will be.
So, Dr. Worden, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's fun, and wish you luck in your endeavors.
Thank you to Dr. Worden for joining the Multiplanetary Society podcast, and thanks to all of you, our listeners. If you like this content, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform to ensure you don't miss an episode, and leave a review to help other people find it. If you have any feedback or guest suggestions, please feel free to email us at multiplanetarysociety, all one word with no dashes, @gmail.com.